A busy old day on the radio. This is Playback Daily. I'm Carol Moran, and here's what you might have missed.
Oh, it was life-changing. Like, I consider HRT my lifeline. It has restored my physical health, but my mental health, more importantly.
Will you tell us about the other book? Because I know that people who write love to hear those stories of rejection. Because
it
gives them
absolutely
hope.
Absolutely. Well, I got 98. 98? I was going to go for 100, and then I thought, why are you doing this?
It is craziness. It's mayhem. It's all of those things. But I suppose, look, we have a small house, but we've got big hearts. Our family has expanded. Our hearts have expanded. The joy that we feel every day to look at Ivana's children experiencing Ireland and going to school, and to see them with Ted and Elsie as well, it is absolutely amazing.
And we'll start here in the afternoon, where Roisin called Katie Hannan about the difficulties she's experiencing about getting her HRT.
Oh, Lord, I'm like a cage here, rattling. My bones are aching all over. I haven't slept in a week. Joint pain, sweating. The lack of HRT in this country is astounding right now.
Okay, yeah, let's just explain to people, Roisin. You got in touch with us, as did many others, we should say, and we'll be talking to hopefully some more of them shortly. People who have got their prescription for HRT, in many cases, after many years, you know, not having one and then getting the relief of that prescription, only now to find that it is a potluck whether you're going to actually get that prescription filled when you go to the pharmacy with it.
Absolutely. I've been all over the country and to no avail. There's absolutely no HRT north or south of the border. My only option right now would be to book a flight, to go to Spain, to walk in off the street to a chemist and be able to buy it over the counter, which is the option we actually don't have here.
Just tell us a little bit about your own story, Roisin. You were diagnosed with breast cancer in your 30s.
Yes, I was. When I was 35, I had a breast cancer diagnosis and I had to have a mastectomy. And when I was 37, as a result of having cancer, I had to have a full hysterectomy. That uterus, tubes, ovaries, the whole lot had to go. And as you know, it's our main sex hormone and we can't make it if we don't have our ovaries. So I didn't go into gradual menopause. I think I woke up in pools of sweat from that operation. So I had what they call car crash menopause. But at the time, nobody actually told me I was going into menopause. I didn't know really anything about menopause. I thought it was something that happened as you got old and your period stopped or whatever. And I had kind of about 2 years where I was just at death's door. I got over all the cancer part of it and now I had this at 37. It was awful. It was horrific. I had to try and find a doctor that would actually prescribe for me. I went to doctors outside of Ireland, got in contact with doctors in the UK, Holland, and they all said, you know, it's a serious estrogen deficiency that I had. However, life became so unbearable. Eventually, I got the help and the treatment that I needed. It was a long battle, but I was prescribed then like HRT. What we have nowadays is body identical HRT, and it's in gel or patch or spray, and it's not synthetic. It's synthesized from, I think, soya and wild yam. So it's actually very, very safe to take. So I eventually got on that treatment. And I think this is the second. Last year we had an awful shortage as well because I remember having to ration my prescriptions as well and travel all over the country to try and source it also. But now the country is dry at the moment. And there's no issues we got.
So what kind of HRT? Because I know you can get HRT delivered in various forms. So what kind of HRT are you on at the moment?
What I'm on is it's transdermal HRT. It's in
these
patches.
These are the patches, yeah.
Yes, the patches. The patch is probably the lifesaver. So I'm on quite high strength of that. And I have the gel either in the pump bottle or the one, the Divi gel in the sachet that you would put onto your skin or put onto your hip or your arm and rub in every day. But me, I have to rub that in twice a day to accompany the patch because the patch alone isn't actually enough for me.
Right. And are all the different types, you know, scarce at the same time, or is there a particular run on a particular patch, say?
Well, this particular HR regime that I am on is all natural. As I said, it's not synthetic because synthetic HRT will raise the bar a little bit as regards the cancer scare. So with with this natural HRT, you're four times less likely to incur a case of cancer, whether it's breast cancer, colon cancer, bowel cancer, or cervical cancer. So it's actually breast protective. It's brain protective, bone protective. I mean, I'm like a skeleton here today. I had to spend today in bed, yesterday in bed. I can't grip a pen today because I can't make it even a fist. My knuckles are also swollen. My hips and my knees are very bad. And you can know on the long term, that's not good for the mental health.
And Roisin wasn't alone. Patricia is also having problems getting her HRT.
I'm on estrogel, which is a gel that you apply on top of your skin. And there are shortages on that one as well. It's not easy to source it at the moment. So I'm still okay, but I'm just dreading my next prescription.
And when did the shortage get really bad this time? Is this just in the last couple of weeks or last month? How long has this been going on?
I'd say we've had shortages now for a good number of months where it's been really touch and go whether you are going to get your prescription exactly on the dates that you need it. Because the thing with HRT is that when you come out of it, it can have really devastating effects on what you've tried to solve for first, right? And even switching from one HRT protocol to another can enchain a number of hormonal changes and bring back your symptoms. So it's very undesirable.
How long have you actually been on HRT, Patricia?
It's been close to a year now.
And was it for, as we heard from so many people who were in contact with Joe on this programme, was it a big relief to you to get on that regime to begin with?
Oh, it was life-changing. Like, I consider HRT my lifeline. It has restored my physical health, but my mental health, more importantly. It was about a year and a half ago that perimenopause hit me like a ton of bricks. I'm a relatively healthy person, sporty, always did the right things. And all of a sudden, completely unaware, because like Roisin mentioned, we don't talk about it. We haven't received any education about women's health in terms of perimenopause and menopause. All this battery of symptoms started to come to me. Hot flashes, brain fog, low mood, depression, mood swings. I was absolutely crippled. And I started to research my options. And the moment HRT entered my life and I started to have it, things turned around almost immediately. And I felt a semblance of my old self coming back, really.
So you have been able to source your last prescription, have you? So are you okay right now?
I'm okay right now. I'm due to get my next prescription end of April. And what I've heard is that there are shortages in estrogel. So, yeah, I'm very anxious. Right now what I feel is anxiety about going to my chemist and not being able to get my next estrogel packet. I just don't know what I do.
Well, that's Patricia, and Liz is in the same boat.
I would think it's a complete outrage, you know, that there's such a short supply of it in the chemist. Like, I've driven to Kerry to get mine.
Where are you based?
I'm based in Mallow.
Right, so...
And I would have different people, different places looking for it for me. Now, it has been okay with a year and a half, but suddenly again, it's about Christmas, it is in short supply in my local and they can't give it to me.
And like, how bad would you have been, Liz, before you got put on this estrogen?
Very bad. I held off on going on it. I'm on it 2 years. But I would have had 50 flushes an hour at night time.
An hour?
Yeah. So you mean it means not sleeping. It means then you get up in the morning and you feel awful in the morning. And you don't feel like exercise, and you eat badly. And then it affects you mentally because you're not out and you're sitting there and you're depressed and you're still having the flushes. Clothes, then you can't wear everything. You're looking and thinking, what can I wear? Can't wear jeans. Has to be something cool. Have a fan at your desk. So the HRT for me definitely keeps all those under control. And the only time I really will get a flush is if I don't exercise. And I do exercise, try to exercise every day. And if I was maybe at a wedding or something and I have a bit of alcohol, a few gins, I will suffer it with a few heat flushes, but nothing like before.
Yeah, you'll pay for that. You'll pay for your few gins.
Yeah. But like, I've heard on my one is Estradot, and I'm on 100 mg. Estradot, apparently, they're trying to redesign the patches, is a lot of the reasons they're in short supply. But, like, I really don't care about the redesign. They say that women give out about the black mark that's left after the patch. I couldn't care less.
God, I'm not surprised when you describe, Liz, your situation before you got that patch.
Well, I kind of tried all the alternative things. I tried everything and anything. And some things worked for some little few months, but then really they weren't.
So in your case, it's Estradot, you say it was, yeah?
Yeah, I'm on Estradot, yeah.
That's a specific issue to do with, you know, how their processes they're doing to improve the patch. Is that's what you've been told?
But they're at that for 2 or 3 years. This isn't just now. Because when I went on the patch, my doctor, first of all, told me I wouldn't be able to get the patches if they weren't available. So actually, I went to my pharmacy and asked my pharmacy what patches they had in stock. And then I went back to my doctor again and said, I can get these ones. But I was told about the issue with production on them. And that's 2.5 years ago.
Liz, Patricia and Roisin, just three of the many, many women contacting Katie Hannan on the live line in the afternoon. And in the morning, Ryan Tuberty wants you to know that he has absolutely nothing, and I repeat that, nothing to do with Bitcoin.
I think I'm going to begin with a quick mention of cryptocurrency scams. And the reason I'm going to do that is because yet another person stopped me yesterday on the street and said, just so you know, I'm on Instagram, and it's great because people on Instagram are very friendly. They're nice people. I like being on Instagram. And the handle is InstaTuberty. If you're interested, you can go along. And it's nice. And I post stuff. I was walking yesterday, getting my steps in for the climb on Saturday. I post the innocent stuff. I get mocked at home for the stuff I post because, you know, it's a man of a certain vintage trying to be something he probably isn't. But, you know, it's just to share things with a different audience that mightn't necessarily listen to this show or watch the Late Show. It's fun. I like it. And it's not too needy, in my opinion. I found Twitter, when I was on it, was very needy. Twitter was a very needy place to be, and I didn't. And then it got ugly. The lads came along with the bags of Linden Village and wrecked it. So we come back to cryptocurrency, and the people stopping me on the street and texting me, or at least messaging me on Instagram, and they're saying, listen, your face keeps coming up in these ads for cryptocurrency. We don't think it's your thing. And I really want to make this really abundantly clear this morning. I have nothing to do with cryptocurrency. I have nothing to do with those ads you see on Facebook and on Instagram and on Twitter. Not one thing. I have nothing to do with these. This is scam. We're living in generation scam. And the internet is alive and thriving with scams and financial cruelty to people who are vulnerable. And I can tell you, when you see my face relating to cryptocurrency or any of these things, I have my friend and colleague Niamh working on this a lot, whereby she is on to the various places that, whether it's Facebook or Instagram or Twitter, and some of them are better than others at getting rid of them. Unfortunately, and this isn't, I appreciate their efforts to try and get rid of these ads and so on. The difficulty is, it's like whack-a-mole. As soon as they get rid of one, another comes up with my face. And the ad says something like, Ryan Tuberty backs cryptocurrency. Do you know what the truth of the matter is? Remember the ad, I don't know what a tracker mortgage. I don't know what cryptocurrency is. To me, it sounds like some ball of smoke thing that it's money, but you can't see it. All right, monorail, straight out of The Simpsons. Monorail, cryptocurrency. Now, I'm sure it's making some people somewhere a load of money. I have nothing to do with it. So please tell all your friends when you see that ad, and they use it, they're really clever, they're sophisticated. They use a screen grab, a photograph from me on the TV. The ad looks really professional anytime I've seen it, and we're trying to get rid of them. But what I don't like about these gangsters is that they're stealing. That's what they're doing. And it's got so bad now that the nearly all the papers, I'm reading Conor Lally in the Irish Times today, saying that people in Ireland have lost millions in cryptocurrency-based frauds. And this is the problem. The gangs involved have developed more sophisticated ways of enticing unsuspecting victims into the bogus investment transactions. Now, I suspect Miriam McCallaghan, when she won that case recently, it was along these lines. And I must say, I admired her for taking the case, because it is costly in terms of time and energy, as well as everything else. But she won the case, and I may not be far behind her if this continues as irritatingly as it has been, because it's too much. And the Garda sources said one victim they're aware of had lost about 1 million euro. But most cases are around 50 grand to 200,000. So people have a lot of money that they invest in. I mean, that's a lot of money to invest. But that's it. So some people have that and off they go. And this money had been stolen after people were enticed into buying non-existent cryptocurrency. Often the victims had visited websites or dealt with bogus sales agents over the phone or via email. However, while the victims believed they were buying cryptocurrency on the promise its value would increase, the currency never existed. Instead, the victims were lodging money into accounts controlled by organised fraud gangs, or were paying for cryptocurrency the gang members controlled. And it's looking at middle-aged people, particularly pensioners. They were being targeted, and they were being contacted by cold calls and texts, or were clicking online adverts that brought them to websites purporting to be trading sites for Bitcoin and other currencies. So that's it. If you see it, be sceptical.
From the Ryan Tubridy Show. And in the afternoon, the author of Lessons in Chemistry, Bonnie Garmus, about the divisive nature of blue and pink, rejection and success in later life.
First book, and I was telling people, if you don't mind, that you're in your 60s. Is that
yes,
okay?
It's fine. it's not a secret.
But you've been, a bit like your protagonist, you've always wanted to write.
Yeah, it just
took a bit longer than most people.
Yeah, a little bit long. Well, I've been writing. I'm a copywriter, and I had written another book, but it didn't go anywhere. So this is my first successful book.
Will you tell us about the other book? Because I know that people who write love to hear those stories of rejection. Because it gives them
absolutely
hope.
Absolutely. Well, I got 98. 98? I was going to go for 100. And then I thought, why are you doing this? So I stopped at 98, because at 98, the 98th agent wrote back and she said, look, I read the first 5,000 pages. I thought it was great. But you have no business writing a 700-page novel.
Oh, she read the first 500 pages and opposed 5,000.
No.
Sorry, I was thinking.
Yeah, it was large. But she told me I had no business writing a debut novel of 700 pages and to write something shorter. She said it in a slightly meaner way than that. But anyway, you know what? I took the advice, and that advice led to Lessons in Chemistry.
Yes, and there's a lot of noise about it.
Yes, there is.
Will you explain to people how that happens? Because the book isn't even on the shelves yet. And yet everyone's talking about it. It's going to be made into an Apple TV miniseries with Brie Larson. So she's producing it, is she? And starring in it?
Yeah, she is. I've got a couple. Jason Bateman also, and Michael Costigan are the producers.
Okay.
Yeah.
So how does it happen? So you eventually got, obviously, an agent, and you got a publisher.
Yeah.
It's Penguin.
Yeah.
And how do they decide then that they're going to, you know, tell people before it's even released that this is brilliant, and they're going to, you know, because that's what's happening, isn't it?
Yeah,
and it is. That's the thing.
Yeah, no, it's been unbelievable. But really, the story starts, you know, after getting all those rejections, I put that novel, my large heavy novel, aside, and I started this one, and then before I had finished this novel, my agent signed me.
Okay.
So she signed me on a partial. I never had to query again. So if anybody is out there querying their novel, it will end eventually. That part, that is so awful.
Yeah. And this started, you were sort of angry, in a bad mood.
Oh, yeah. I'm a little embarrassed about that. But yes, this started with a very bad mood. I'd been in a meeting one day, and this guy had been fairly disrespectful to me in the meeting. And afterwards, a couple people in the meeting had apologized to me for him, but he never said a word. At any rate, I was so mad after that meeting that I went back to my desk, and instead of working on what I was supposed to be working on, I wrote the first chapter of Lessons in Chemistry.
Right. Okay. There's a lot of it in it. It's men's attitudes to women, and Elizabeth is sort of the lightning rod for that. It's set in the 50s, 60s, and you cover so many themes in it, but in such an entertaining way.
Oh, thank you.
It's a bit like a feminist manifesto, really, isn't it?
Kind of, Yeah, you know, it's interesting, though, because in the book, what I try to also bring out is that men are under the same sort of societal limitations that women are. It's just in a different form. And so there are a lot of men, like, say, Walter Pine in the book, who's being told to be more aggressive, more this way. And it's not
by that man. Yes.
And so, my point was that, you know, we're all just people. And what Elizabeth is trying to say is we're actually just atoms and molecules. And do we really have any business acting like we're more than that? I mean, what we really are, these ideas that we have from society are really based on myth. And so what she's saying...
There's your thing. And I think that's the crux of the book. I've marked it there. You might disagree, but would you read it for us?
Yeah. Men and women are both human beings, and as humans, we're byproducts of our upbringings, victims of our lackluster educational systems, and choosers of our own behaviors. In short, the reduction of women to something less than men and the elevation of men to something more than women is not biological. It's cultural. And it starts with two words, pink and blue. Everything skyrockets out of control from there.
Yes.
That's one of my favorite parts. Thank you.
And Bonnie spoke about the unexpected nature of the publicity circuit after the solitary endeavor of writing the book.
Oh, no, it's fantastic, but it's a lot, you know, and it's completely unexpected when you labor away as a writer does alone every day. And I wrote alone also as a copywriter. When you're always writing alone, you get used to being alone. And it's where you feel most comfortable. So suddenly being thrust like this into the limelight is quite difficult for me. But people are so nice and they've been so generous about the book. And so I really have no complaints.
Yeah. How long did it take you to write?
5 years.
Right.
Yeah.
It fascinates me, you know, that you would spend 5 years on a project and not knowing.
Not knowing.
Might be another 98 rejections coming your way.
I was pretty sure. You know, I don't like to have a lot of people read what I'm writing. But I did occasionally explain to a friend, oh, I'm writing this book. And they'd say, oh, what's it about? And I'd say, oh, it's about this chemist. And she's on a cooking show. And they go, you might want to hang on to that day job. You know, and they were right in some ways. But I've just never been good at explaining my own writing.
And she's had a tough life, Elizabeth Zott. Her family background, her dad was a sort of a pay-to-pray type guy
exactly.
who toured, ended up in prison. Yep. His mum went off with somebody else down to Brazil. So she ended up sort of an orphan. But science kept her on the straight and narrow, didn't it?
Yep.
And it made sense of the world for her.
Right, exactly right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we already read that out about, you know, sexism that doesn't exist in science.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And then you turn your attention to religion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. One of the themes throughout the book is the idea that people lie all the time. And religion can be a very large deception in our lives. There's so many religions. Everybody maintains their religion is the real one. And these religions, they can offer a lot of solace. They can also do an enormous amount of harm. And so what she's saying is, you know, basically, I hate to say it, but there is no God. That's what she says.
Yes.
You know, I'm an atheist. And for her to say that on the airwaves in the 1960s, wow. I mean, even when I was writing, I was like, you are in so much trouble now.
Elizabeth Zott, you're in so much.
Are you sure?
Is that the way you write? Because it sounds like that's sort of hindsight. You're nearly embellishing a story, you know, because that's what you do. That's what you do for a living.
Well, it is kind of funny, though, with her. There would be times where I think, I've got to pull back. I've got to pull back because people won't like her or whatever. And then I thought, you know, I kept thinking she would say, I don't care about likability.
Mm.
I care about truth. I care about science. I care about progress. I care about curiosity. I want to see things change. And change is what we do. It's what chemistry is. It's the natural order of things.
Bonnie Garmus. The book is called Lessons in Chemistry from The Ray D'Arcy Show. And on Morning Ireland, Cathy and Keith Wheatley and their mission to help the Ukrainian woman who was the surrogate to their twins.
A surrogate mother who carried twins for an Irish couple almost 3 years ago has moved from Ukraine to the safety of their home in County Wicklow. Cathy Wheatley travelled to the border of Ukraine and Romania 2 weeks ago, from where she brought Ivana Hulub and her three children back to Ireland. While an Oireachtas committee is currently examining proposed legislation around surrogacy in this country, under current law, Ivana is the legal mother of Cathy's twins. Our social affairs correspondent Alva Keneally reports.
Springtime in County Wicklow means there are new additions on the Wheatley farm. But 2 weeks ago, there were new additions to the household also. Cathy and Keith Wheatley had their twins via a surrogate in Ukraine over 2 years ago. They've remained in close contact with Ivana Hulub since.
Teddy and Elsie, who is Ivana? Why were you in Ivana's tummy? Mommy's tummy was broke, wasn't it?
When the invasion occurred in Ukraine, Cathy travelled to Romania to get Ivana and her three children out of the country. She recalls the moment they finally met at a camp on the Romanian border.
I can't even find the words to describe what it was like to get there. Ivana was on the phone. We were trying to find each other in the camp. And I could hear her, because we were all very emotional, and I could hear her, and I ran around trying to find her. And then one of the volunteers started shouting, "Here, here, here." And I ran in, and Ivana ran out, and we gave each other the biggest hug, possible. And then we got the boys, and yeah, that was it.
As the surrogate of Cathy's twins, under Irish law, Ivana is the legal mother of Ted and Elsie. And while legislation is currently being teased out in the Oireachtas to address the matter, people did question Cathy's decision to bring Ivana back to Ireland.
You had a lot of people who said, "Cathy, think this true. You know, is it going to leave your children in a precarious situation? What's going to happen?" I suppose because war is war, there are no rules. And in this situation, I couldn't think of anything, only the safety of Ivana and her children. And if that left us legally in a vulnerable position, so be it, we would deal with it. I'm very lucky, obviously, the relationship that we have with Ivana. But yes, under Irish law, I'm not recognised as my twin's mother. And, you know, it is something it's a bitter pill to swallow. It really is. And having Ivana here is absolutely fantastic. But it highlights the fact, you know, that, you know, legally in Ireland, whoever gives birth to the baby is recognised as being its mother. Ivana gave birth to my babies, but as Ivana, I'd say, there's absolutely, you know, they're not Ivana's babies, just like Luda's not my baby. And so it's, you know, for us, we're able to work it out. We absolutely understand it. But to not have that legal protection, you know, is difficult. Irish Families for Surrogacy, who I'm part of their organisation, they've been a tremendous support to us in everything from start to finish. And I suppose it's not just us in this position. There's lots of families who have brought their surrogates over if their surrogates want to come over.
Ivana is aware of the legal position, but as a surrogate and through a translator, she's very clear in her view of what her role was for Cathy and Keith.
Легко.
I feel glad that Katie's children are in safe here, and I give them life and my health, and it's very great that these children have such good parents, and I'm very happy for them, and the parents have their children. And I don't understand this negative position of people who don't understand, and they don't understand that this is the mission, and God bless this woman to give a birth for these children and to make happy their parents.
Are you going to give Oleg a kiss? Give Oleg a kiss.
Now, a two-bedroom cottage, which was once home to a family of four, houses three adults and five children.
Yeah, it is craziness. It's mayhem. It's all of those things. But I suppose, look, we have a small house, but we've got big hearts. Our family has expanded. Our hearts have expanded. The joy that we feel every day to look at Ivana's children experiencing Ireland and going to school and to see them with Ted and Elsie as well. It is absolutely amazing.
Alva Keneally's report for Morning Ireland. And on Today with Claire Byrne, Professor Luke O'Neill, who is delivering medicine to Ukraine.
Well, I'm joined now by Professor Luke O'Neill, who you all know, of course, Professor of Biochemistry in the School of Biochemistry and Immunology at Trinity College Dublin. But, Luke, this is different from our conversations about COVID. You're joining us from somewhere in Central Europe. Where are you?
That's right, Claire. We're just north of Frankfurt, actually, about 2 hours from the Polish border, with Medical Help Ukraine. They're an organisation bringing medical supplies basically into Poland. And we should get to Poland maybe early tomorrow. And then all those medical supplies get picked up and brought into Ukraine. So it's a bit different from my usual job, I guess.
Certainly is. And how did you get involved in this?
Yeah, I got involved because medical friends asked me to help out, really, you know. And it's a fantastic organisation. They've sent in 5 million euros worth of medical supplies already. And the great thing is it goes direct to hospitals in Ukraine. It was set up by a bunch of Ukrainian doctors. In Ireland, Katia Kasharets was the leader of this, really, you know. And it really is a great example because a lot of medical supplies have been provided, medical equipment, and loads of it's gone across already. And tomorrow now we're expecting another several truckloads, really, to be transported into Ukraine.
So take us through your journey then. You're heading from where you are now into Poland, is that right?
That's right, yeah. We got the ferry over to Cherbourg and then we've been driving really since then, you know. And the big plan is to arrive tomorrow. And then 3 Ukrainian doctors are flying in from Ireland to meet us, you know, and then they're going to actually cross the border then with their Ukrainian colleagues. There's a set of trucks driving over actually from Ukraine with doctors on board, you know, and we'll transfer all our gear. I'm in a truck at the moment actually in a service station full of medical supplies. The big need, Claire, is bandages and all kinds of trauma gear, you know, and that's exactly what we have in our truck. In fact, the head of Medicine Sans Frontières, he said it's the biggest need now. It's a critical challenge to provide stuff for trauma because there's so much injury happening there and so many wounds and so on, you know.
Yeah, it's awful to think about it. But what you're getting and your colleagues there, the doctors, you're getting information directly from medics in Ukraine. They're telling you exactly what they need. So rather than bringing them items that they don't want and they've no use for, it's very targeted.
Yeah, they've given us a shopping list, effectively, which arrived over about a week ago. And we fill that list, which is great, you know, because obviously it's directly needed. And it's things like tourniquets. You know, we're talking like frontline medical supplies that are run out of, you see. So, of course, what's great is we can now provide that directly to where it's needed in the hospital. There's 3 hospitals hooked up directly here, and we're basically filling up their shopping list is the idea.
And as you said, this isn't the first consignment from the organised by the Ukrainian doctors in Ireland, because another one went in February.
It did, that's right. Yeah, there's been 2 articulated trucks have gone in, for example, and ambulances. Another part of it is a guy called David Hall, who's with Lifeline Ambulances. He's donated ambulances. They've driven over full of medical supplies. And the ambulances now have stayed in Ukraine, by the way, because they need ambulances as well. So it really is a very targeted thing. And by the way, Claire, our truck is provided by PRL and Kilkenny. They gave the truck to us to fill, you see, so very grateful to them. Loads of people are providing medical supplies, Clonmel Healthcare, even Glennon's Pharmacy in Glastool gave us a whole set of first aid kits, for instance, which we have in the back of the van as well. So there's been a fantastic response to this, really.
So what happens? You drop off the supplies. They're taken into Ukraine by Ukrainian doctors and medics and ambulance drivers. Do you come back then with the empty truck?
Yeah, so then we're moving south then to Bratislava, actually, because I'm also involved with DePaul, who have a medical supply chain from Bratislava. So our plan is to drive on to Bratislava, give a hand there on our way back, because we can kind of drive home via Bratislava is the idea. And then we drive back, exactly. PRL want their truck back, basically, understandably. So we've got to get the truck back over again. We arrive back in Ireland, I think, on Thursday. Next Thursday, actually, is the plan.
Okay. And are you hearing that the efforts are successful so far? Like, is the group hearing from Ukraine that these supplies that are going in, that they're making a difference and they're getting to where they need to get to?
Definitely. Because, I mean, it's a terrible tragedy, Claire, anyway. Can you believe the 100 healthcare facilities were bombed, you see? And, of course, that means all the equipment was destroyed. The supply lines into these hospitals are broken. So they've run out of all these essential sort of supplies, I guess. And then the second thing is they're running out of meds as well. They need antibiotics, they need insulin. And again, we have lots of antibiotics to deliver too, and that'll be a separate ship that needs a special license, you see. So they need basic medical, drugs and medicines and so on, and medical supplies. And absolutely, it goes straight to where the action is, basically, and it's used immediately as it is. So it really is working.
And this is unlikely to be the last run, and Medical Help Ukraine are asking for people to donate, aren't they, so they can do this again?
That's the big message. You can go online. It's a GoFundMe account, Medical Help Ukraine. If people search for that, they'll find it. And we'll accept any donations at all, of course. We're getting lots of free stuff, but money obviously is needed to help continue this. And you're right, this is going to go on for weeks, they reckon, because, again, the crisis is still very evident there, you know. Okay. And so the more stuff we can get over there, the better.
MedicalHelpUkraine.com for more on that. Professor Luke O'Neill from Today with Claire Byrne. And in the morning, a chat about dating and then becoming a parent when you're visually impaired. Jade McCormack, who has low vision, had a reunion of sorts with Ryan Tuberty.
So I think it was around 2013. Mm-hmm. I had not been in Dublin very long, and I was walking up Grafton Street after a singing lesson. Mm-hmm. And I had a guide dog at the time, and I was working her, and it was very busy. So I was kind of just, you know, I kept walking, and next thing I hear, "Oh my God, I'm so sorry." And my friend said, "Do you know who just bumped into you?" And I said, "No, should I?" And she said, "It was Ryan Tuberty." And I went, "No, it wasn't." And she said, "It was. It genuinely was." She said, "Why didn't you stop and say hello to him?"
Yeah, why didn't you stop and say hello?
Because I was working my dog.
Yeah, okay. I bumped into you. You didn't bump into me. No. Can we make this clear? That I'm the one who wasn't looking where I was going. Is that what happened?
That's what happened.
Do you know how much of a fool I feel now?
I'm very sorry.
No, don't be sorry. I'm the one who's an idiot. Which dog? What was the dog?
So the dog's name was Yanni. She's still alive. She's 14 and has been retired since 2018.
I'm interested in the terminology you used there, Jade. You were working your dog. What does that mean? Was you training it in? Or?
No. So what I mean by working the dog is she was in her working equipment. So she had her harness on and I was holding the handle and walking down the street. So she was guiding me around all the people and obstacles and things like that. So I wouldn't bump into anybody or bump into anything.
Unless a lanky fool bumps into
you. You're not the only
you.
One that has bumped into me, and I'm sure you won't be the last.
No, I know, but you would think, given that you're there with probably a high-vis jacket on the dog, Yanni, and you walking along by, that I might, you know, spot such a thing.
Well, she, to be fair, and I'll give you your credit, she was tiny. She was very small, like she was just a little below my knee.
Oh.
So she was very small, and I've been on trains and buses, and people would often say to me, "Sorry, can you move your bag?
Your four-legged bag."
It's a dog.
Your bag's very happy.
And
his tail,
like,
is wagging.
Oh, you see, she used to just lie at my feet in a ball, and people would be, "Can you move your bag?" I'm like, "It's a guide dog." "Oh, I'm so sorry."
That's a very discreet guide dog you have there.
Yeah, she was very good.
Jade, I need to know all about you. So give us an idea of who you are and where you're from and a bit of background.
So I'm originally from a place called Fermoy in County Cork.
Oh, sure, we know it well.
And I grew up there, and I've lived in Dublin, I think, 9 years now.
Mm-hmm.
Moved up originally just because I wanted a change of scenery and all that kind of thing.
And what were you into as a child?
Everything.
Really?
I loved and still love music, technology.
Yeah.
Cooking.
Oh, good. You've got it's a bit of everything there.
Yeah, reading.
Let's talk about the music. What are you into?
Everything and anything. As long as it's not rap music, I can't.
Can't go there.
No, I can't.
Wrong with that?
I respect rap artists, but my ears are very delicate.
And it's just too much, is it?
It's just too much.
Not even Kanye West or something?
No, I can't.
Or Kanye, say yay, I should say. None of that. Okay, so what's your, like, desert island-y music? What's a definite?
So I absolutely love, like, old 60s music.
Good.
Irish traditional folk music.
Yeah, lovely.
And I'm going to go out on a limb here.
Do it.
And my guilty pleasure
is
Nathan Carter.
Right. Hey, there's nothing guilty about that.
So,
the great Nathan Carter.
Yeah, I've seen him loads of times, more times than I can count.
Yeah.
But yeah, he'd be a guilty pleasure of mine.
I love that you say you've seen him.
Yeah, so I suppose people always get wrapped up in the terminology, but how can you see him if you can't see?
Yeah.
But I'm still allowed to use those phrases.
Are you?
I still, believe it or not.
I can't believe it. I thought there might be something in the Constitution.
Yeah. No, so we, like, just because I can't see, it doesn't mean that I don't use the same terms of phrase or, you know, and I have a little bit of sight. I think in the article that came out a couple of weeks ago, I said, it's not enough to read a page of print, but it's enough that I can make out my surroundings and know that I'm, say, in a building or, you know, I'm not going to put myself in danger.
And so Jane described meeting her husband for the first time.
So in 2012, a mutual friend said, I have to ring this guy. And she rang him and he was on loudspeaker. And I said, he sounds nice. Mm-hmm. So I obviously wouldn't go by looks. I would go by how somebody sounds or how they come across, you know, personality wise. Mm-hmm. And she said, oh, yeah, I think he's single. But nothing ever came of it. And then another friend of mine said, oh, he's lovely. And said, add him on Facebook. So I did that. And we were messaging back and forward. And then he's like, oh, I presume, would you like to meet? And I was kind of saying, well, OK, let's do it. Mm-hmm. And then we met up. And
where did you meet?
We met in Dublin. We met out in Chapel Lizard, as it happens, through mutual friends.
So let me ask the big clunky questions about your, you know, with your eyesight the way it is. Do you describe yourself as blind?
Is there a term I need to use?
I
have low vision.
Okay, so you're a low vision person.
Yeah.
And you say, okay, I'll see you at 1 o'clock at this place.
Yeah.
How does that work with Andy then?
Loads of people
then?
Ask me that. How do blind people meet each other?
Well, I'm dying to know. I'm curious. Is it okay to ask you?
Of course, okay. I'm not averse to questions.
Oh, good on you.
So what we did was we had arranged to meet at a particular building. It was Madigan's on Abbey Street, mm-hmm. Where we met first. And we'd said, go inside and, you know, I'll hear you. He said, I'll hear you. So I thought, grand. He was late. I thought, he's not coming.
How will he hear you?
So next thing, I heard him, as it happens, I heard the cane. Like, he used a white stick at the time.
And he's also blind?
Yes.
Oh, hang on. That's a bit of detail.
Okay, sorry.
Oh, come on. Jeez, you know your story. You're only sharing it with a few heads here. Okay, you knew that, obviously,
I
before
this. I knew this, yeah.
So you'd hear the cane
so
hitting the ground.
So I heard the cane coming.
Okay, gotcha.
He has a white stick that has a roller tip, so it was rolling, so it kind of sounds like a suitcase.
Okay, dog.
Like the dog snoring.
Yeah. Okay, so
but I had the dog at the time, so I heard the cane coming, and I said to my friend, is that him? And she said, he said, I think so. Like, it was his friend that had introduced us. So he said, I think it's him. And he turns up and he's like, Paul, how are you? So he'd obviously recognised his own friend's voice and was chatting to him. And then Paul said, well, Jade's here. Do you want to say hello to her? And Andy was like, oh, hi. The two of us were kind of, you know, very shy, very awkward. Yeah. So we had agreed to meet again on our own. And we met under the clock at Cleary's.
Old school.
Old school.
Yeah, okay. Like a style.
And he got me lost. He said he knew O'Connell Street. He knew Dublin. You know, I'll bring you back to Houston. No bother. I didn't know Dublin. Bear this in mind. I had never really been up before. And he's like, I'll get you back on the Lewis. But he got me lost.
Okay.
And I said, did you do this on purpose to get me to miss my train? He said, no, I didn't, I swear. And then he asked me out on the Lewis.
And so it was the start of something beautiful. So Ryan asked about Andy.
Andy, was he born without sight?
He was. So he has a condition called Leber's amaurosis. He has what's called light perception. Mm-hmm. So where I have some vision that I can kind of make out my surroundings, he just sees light. Like, he can tell you if it's sunny, not just by feeling the heat, but the light would drive his eyes crazy.
Is the idea, let's take personalities aside, because you've got obviously buckets of personalities. So I don't know Andy, but I presume he's pretty much the same. Take personality aside, are there easier places to go for people with such low vision for a date than, say, somebody with perfect vision?
I think it's personal preference. So for me, I will always pick places where the staff know me, where the staff are good to me.
Really?
Yes. Where I kind of know my way around the place. So I will always pick places that I'm familiar with.
Can you name some places where the staff are brilliant?
So our local in Balbriggan, so the Harvest Inn.
They're great.
They are fantastic.
Great. Well, I love giving credit to them.
Yeah,
you know, where
they're brilliant. Like it's got to the stage where the chef is even like, "Oh, is that for Jade and Andy?"
Oh. Jade and Andy. I even feel that there's a Jandy.
Oh, he says that?
He said, I knew he would. It's a matter of time. You're that's one of those couples where the chef knows.
Yeah. So, like, because he'll kill me for saying this, mm-hmm. but Andy will go to a restaurant and if he wants a dish and he knows it's going to be messy, but he really wants it, he'll say, "Would you mind asking the chef to put that in a bowl? And can I have a spoon?"
Okay, well, that's, you know, he knows what he wants. He knows his mind. You got married.
Unfortunately.
What was your first dance? I'm always interested in that.
God. What was it?
Oh, really? And here's the music.
Eric Clapton, Tears... not Tears in Heaven. God, the Way You Looked... Wonderful
Tonight. That's the one.
Yeah.
And I said, "Darling, you look wonderful."
So the story
tonight.
Behind that was when Andy got his first dog, Nico.
Yeah.
Back in 2014.
Mm-hmm.
I went to visit him because I wanted to meet Nico. I'm a sucker for dogs. I love dogs. Fuck. And I wanted to meet Nico before Nico came home. So I went and I met him. And there was this lad, I can't for the life of me remember his name, but he was playing guitar and singing to a group of blind people in Irish Guide Dogs.
Okay.
And he picked this song. And myself and Andy just collapsed into a fit of hysterics.
Why?
Because we were like, you know, he's singing this song to a load of blind people.
Saying, "You
and
look
then,
wonderful tonight." Yeah. Okay, come on, oh, that took me a minute. Oh, that's so funny. So you got the giggles in the back of the class.
We were sitting right in front of him, laughing. And he was kind of like, I don't get it. And I said, "I'm sorry." I said, "It's just funny that you sing this to a group of blind people."
Of all the songs. "You've got the look. Stop singing songs about visual." Anyway, I get it. And you saw the humour in it. And
we
then,
did, yeah.
And Ryan asked Jade about finding out she was pregnant.
When you were told you were going to be expecting a child, how did you feel?
My first reaction was, "I can't do this."
Was that a serious reaction?
It was very serious. I remember the so I magnify things using my phone, and I remember doing the pregnancy test, sitting in the bathroom, so I wouldn't wake anybody. So my sister was living with us at the time. And I remember sitting in the bathroom, I think it was like 6 o'clock in the morning, and I turned on the light, magnified it with my phone, and the plus sign just slapped me in the face. And I went, "I can't do this."
Why not?
I just thought, like, both of us are visually, well, I'm low vision and Andy is blind. And I went, like, that's tricky enough to navigate in itself.
Mm-hmm.
Add a child into the mix. I can't do this. And then I remember going to the doctor. She confirmed it. And I was like, I have to tell somebody because I can't do this. So I told my sister. She was in college and studying in Maynooth at the time. And she was like, "You can do this." I was like, "No, I can't." She said, "You can. You will do this. I am having a niece."
Okay.
Or a nephew at the time because we didn't know.
Yeah.
And I was like, "Oh God, I'm gonna have to move home to Cork. I need my mammy." It was just one of those "I need my mammy" instances.
Yeah, yeah, you know? Yeah. No, I know what you mean.
So I was like, I need to move home to Cork. But unfortunately, the public transport and the, you know, sort of getting around mobility wise, being independent in that small town isn't really possible. And there's only like one bus to the city or one bus to Dublin. Like you can't go anywhere else. So I thought, no, I think I'm better in Dublin where I can do things myself. Let's just see how this goes.
So you got your head around it and you had a baby.
We had a baby.
A human baby girl child.
Yes. Her name is Sive Lily.
Ah, congratulations. That was 2 years ago.
2.5 years ago.
Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you. And she's a little diva.
Now, you're I think for when people become a mum or dad for the first time, it's a crazy world to live in.
I don't think it matters whether you're blind, deaf.
There is that.
It doesn't matter. It's overwhelming. You're filled with this, "Oh my God, I made this thing. I'm responsible for this."
Yeah. You had slightly more to be worried about, let's face it.
I was very ready. I knew by the time I went to the hospital and I spoke to the nurses and the midwives and, you know, I knew. I was like, okay, I can do this. I'm ready for this. Yeah. I can do this. They were all so supportive and so good. I thought, okay, this is going to be easy. And then she came along and everything just changes. You forget about the "I can't do this." And I always say your sort of your maternal instinct kicks in and you just go with the flow. You just listen to her cues.
When you held her for the first time, think about that moment for a second. How much of her could you see and what did you feel physically and emotionally?
I just remember feeling so tired. I remember my first reaction was, oh my God, she's here. Because I was in labour all day and I just was like, she's here. So then I had asked for skin to skin. So they put her on my chest and I remember feeling, oh my God, she's mine. Like, this little thing is mine. And physically, all I remember feeling was her trying to get milk. And I was like, okay, let's do this.
Welcome to the rest of your life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was that.
And that was that.
She's a very independent child. Like, she's not a very sit on your lap for snuggles all day. You know, she's not that child.
How does it work in terms of the house? And, you know, as you say, regardless of what height, sight or hearing you have, it's quite hard when a baby grows.
Yes.
And makes its presence felt around the house. Did you have to do extra special or different things?
So I've always been a bit of a neat freak. I like things in a place. Everything has to be tidy. I'm just like that.
Okay.
So what we did was we kind of worked on a system of, you know, we'd get to listen to her and like we had dogs in the house and, you know, we'd just kind of learn to hear her and she'd make little noises and then she started crawling and I thought, oh no, here comes the problems. So all I did was, I am Disney obsessed. So I got rid of all my like ornaments and things like that. And I was like, okay, they're going in a box and probably never more to be seen.
Yeah, not in her mouth. Yeah, yeah.
Jade McCormick from The Ryan Tubridy Show. And on Morning Ireland, the rising costs of just about everything, in particular the hike in energy bills. Here's Gavin Jennings.
Electric Ireland has become the latest energy supplier here to announce a big price increase, adding around €300 a year to electricity bills and €220 a year to gas bills. From the 1st of May, the average electricity bill will go up by 23.4%. The average gas bill will go up by 24.8%. The company said that sustained changes in the wholesale cost of energy continues to drive price adjustments. Our reporter Sinead Spain has been asking people this morning in Maynooth about the rising energy bills.
Absolutely. I had this conversation with my partner yesterday after getting the text about increases in our own charges. And I think, unfortunately, it's something we really have to sit down and plan for. I don't think it's going to be the last of them. And I think, yeah, our plan for the next couple of years is definitely going to change from it. We definitely need to reprioritise. It's not something we were expecting coming out of a global pandemic, but unfortunately, it is what it is.
It's gone crazy. The cost of living, the wages hasn't gone up. It's just bizarre, and the war in Europe hasn't helped.
From Morning Ireland with Gavin Jennings. And on Today with Claire Byrne, on Taoiseach Micheál Martin.
On Taoiseach Micheál Martin, you're very welcome to the studio. Thanks for coming in today. We've a lot to discuss, but the first thing I want to talk to you about is something that people will be, I'm sure, talking about today. Because you said to your parliamentary party meeting last night, when they were pushing you on cutting the VAT rate on fuel, you said the price of fuel is not your biggest concern. Are you concerned about fuel shortages?
Well, sorry, yeah, I did say that in terms of the... First of all, we have to look at this over the 12-month perspective now. This is not something that we can respond to on a week-to-week basis. It needs a longer time frame. So in that context, not just in Ireland, but right across Europe, energy security and security of supply is a key issue, and particularly as Europe reduces its dependency on Russian gas and oil. And that's a clearly stated objective now of the European Union.
So how worried are you?
Countries like Germany, for example, are very determined to do that.
You'll see the front of this today. Taoiseach, we could run out of winter fuel.
But I never said that. That's not the phrase I used at all. I simply used the phrase energy security is an issue that the government is focused on. And also that would mean then we have to look at demand reduction sort of strategies as well and a more informed approach. over the medium term, a planned approach to this, insofar as we can, but in a period of great uncertainty arising out of the Ukrainian war.
It's quite something to hear you saying you're more concerned about that than you are about the price of it.
Well, I think, again, look, I think comments are being taken out of context. We are very concerned about the cost and the rising course we are. It's not an either or. But what I'm trying to convey to people is the need that we need to look at this over a longer time frame than just a week-to-week basis. Okay. So that every week there will, you know, we're getting increases. And if you look at the cost of gas a year ago compared to today, it's just an exponential growth. So therefore, we need a medium-term strategy to address this. We've already allocated about $2 billion from the budget onwards in alleviating pressures on people. But obviously, the price rises have continued because of the war on Ukraine, which have exacerbated the situation. So therefore, there's a number of things we must do as we plan ahead for the fiscal situation and the budget next year. We have to target our resources to people who are hardest hit and to those who are suffering the most.
Okay.
We have to look after sectors like we did with the hauliers, agriculture, where input costs are high.
Can I come to those measures in a moment? Because I really want to nail this down, because when you have a headline like that, you know what it's going to lead to. People panic.
Well, I'm not
buying.
Responsible for the headline now, and that phrase is not one I used
at
all.
But you did say the price of fuel is not your biggest concern.
No, I didn't use that phrase either. I mean, there's what I've simply said. Energy security is something we have to focus on and prepare for over the next winter period.
But are you confident, for example, that we have a 90-day supply here?
Yeah, we
fuel?
Have that. Yeah, yeah.
And people needn't be concerned, and they shouldn't go out and panic buy.
Absolutely not. No need for that. But I think we need to, the very important point is this. This is a longer haul than people might have anticipated because of the war in Ukraine. We already had problems coming out of COVID, very fast rebounded the economy, imbalance between supply and demand, and prices were going up.
Mm-hmm.
War on Ukraine happens, and a very dramatic escalation in oil and gas prices as a result of that, with consequential impacts on the wider economy. Food security is an issue for us also.
Yeah.
And I made that point last evening to the parliamentary party, that the knock-on from war in terms of grain, in terms of food issues, nutrition, could be further problems in
down
developing countries,
yep.
Which creates further migratory flows and further potential conflict in developing countries arising from the food security issue. So there are very serious issues emanating from the war, in short.
And the push on you last night was about VAT on fuel, wasn't it? And people might look at this and say, well, I've got a really big bill to deal with here now, right? So what we're looking at is, on the one hand, people are getting €200 for their fuel bill, and they'll welcome that, no doubt. But you're trying to change behaviour then, on the other hand, by increasing carbon tax in May. Is it all a bit mad, doing the two things in tandem?
Well, first of all, the war has created a situation where we have to stand back from what business as usual and reassess the short-term measures that we have to take, but then double down on renewables. One very clear policy shift that is emerging from this crisis is the need to accelerate renewable energy, not just here but across Europe, and that is a policy position that has been adopted by the European Union. In the short term, across Europe, they're doing everything they can to get short term supplies in through LNG and other mechanisms to reduce their dependence on Russian gas and oil. We are not as dependent on Russian gas and oil as others are. Our primary imports are from the UK and from Norway. But nonetheless, we do have to adapt, and we're going to have to assess all of these issues.
Yeah, what's the message, though, that we're sending? You know, you're looking at and being asked by your parliamentary party to look at VAT on fuel, but you're increasing it on the carbon side.
Well, that wasn't the dominant issue last evening in terms of that. But I hear your point in terms of, like, the carbon tax is a more permanent feature. It's legislated for. Reductions in VAT or excise duties of necessity would be temporary to deal with the current crisis. The carbon tax gives revenue to enable us to do energy efficiency, for example, to do the retrofitting in homes, mm-hmm. which ultimately is a better way to get people to have lower bills well into the future.
Which is grand. But if I'm trying to pay for my petrol at the petrol station,
an increase in May, people can't take that.
That's just an excerpt from the interview with Taoiseach Micheál Martin from Today with Claire Byrne. And that's it for Playback Daily. So mind yourself till next time.